Se declara abierta la 11ª sesión del Foro Permanente para las Cuestiones Indígenas. Distinguidos miembros del foro, esta mañana, de conformidad con su programa de trabajo, el Foro Permanente seguirá examinando el tema 7 del programa titulado Labor Futura del Foro Permanente, incluidas las cuestiones relacionadas con el Consejo Económico y Social, nuevas cuestiones, presentación y examen de los siguientes informes. Informe sobre los pueblos indígenas y los internados. Estudio preliminar de las consecuencias que tiene para los pueblos indígenas. Se está yendo, Tonia. Para los pueblos indígenas, la teoría jurídica internacional conocida como la doctrina del descubrimiento, que ha servido de fundamento para la violación de sus derechos humanos. Examen de cuestiones relacionadas con Beijing más 15. Vamos a ofrecer la palabra a la señora Tonia Gonella Frichner para que haga la exposición del estudio preliminar de las consecuencias que tiene para los pueblos indígenas teoría jurídica internacional conocida como la doctrina del descubrimiento, que ha servido de fundamento para la violación de sus derechos humanos. Vamos a invitar también a los... ¿Me entiendo? ¿Aquí? Inmediatamente. ¿Sí? Señora Gonella Frichner, tiene usted la palabra.
La señora ha pedido que al primero llama
a... Sí, yo lo voy a llamar, pues, pero que hable. ¿Vale? No lo sabía, lo veía.
¿A quién le tiene que dar la palabra?
I will try this again, Mr. Chairman. Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for calling me on this particular agenda item. I'd like to give warm greetings to all my distinguished colleagues and all the distinguished representatives in the room, and greet them in the Onondaga language of Nahue Haskanu. I am pleased to announce, Mr. Chairman, the completion of the preliminary study of the Doctrine of Discovery, which was requested by the 8th session of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. The preliminary study is now translated and available under the title Impact on Indigenous Peoples of the International Legal Construct Known as the Doctrine of Discovery, which has served as the violation of their human rights. The preliminary study of the Doctrine of Discovery is mentioned in the Indigenous Peoples Global Caucus Statement and the Indigenous Women's Caucus Statement, and in the report of the North American Caucus Preparatory Meeting held in the territory of the Alexis Nakota Sioux Nation in Canada. It is also mentioned in the intervention of the Indigenous Youth Caucus. Mr. Chairman, there is now a great deal of support for the convening of an expert group meeting on the Doctrine of Discovery. and for a comprehensive study of the doctrine to be conducted by a representative from each of the seven regions identified by the permanent form. Mr. Chairman, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is a significant step in the direction of honoring and upholding Indigenous peoples' human rights, individual and collective, including the right to and of self-determination. The Declaration is the product of Indigenous peoples working towards solving a problem they all share. However, the problem is not to be found in the actual text of the Declaration, and this is the importance of the preliminary study. Mr. Chairman, the preliminary study identifies this shared problem as the legal construct known as the Doctrine of Discovery, an interpretive framework that has resulted and continues to result in violations of Indigenous peoples' human rights throughout the world. That interpretive framework is the root problem facing Indigenous peoples. As identified in the preliminary study, it has two main elements. First, Mr. Chairman, dehumanization, and second, dominance. The first thing Indigenous peoples share is the experience of having been invaded by those who treated us without compassion because they considered us to be less than human or not even human. Dehumanization leads to the second thing we as Indigenous peoples share in common, being treated on the basis of the belief that those who invaded our territories have a right of lordship or dominance over our existence, and therefore have the right to take, grant, and dispose of our lands, territories, and resources without our permission or consent. This is the reason why a discussion of the human right of free, prior, and informed consent is critically important with regard to Indigenous nations and peoples. Mr. Chairman, the preliminary study is a first step toward resolving the root problem the Declaration is intended to address. Indigenous peoples are woven into the biological fabric of their traditional territories, which they are charged with a sacred responsibility to maintain for future generations. What is now referred to as a biological diversity is a direct result of Indigenous nations and peoples upholding that sacred responsibility for thousands of years. Now, others think they have the right to take, commodify, and even destroy these biosystems. And their dehumanization and domination based on the doctrine of discovery are steps toward that end. Once the Indigenous protection based on ecological knowledge and wisdom is removed, Mr. Chairman, the biological and ecological integrity of the traditional territory of a particular Indigenous nation is open to attack from the forces of mining and other forms of biosphere exploitation and destruction. The removal of Indigenous peoples' protection leads to destruction of the waters, trees, animals, and all other life forms, intricately interwoven and networked with the lives of the Indigenous peoples. Mr. Chairman, this is what Indigenous peoples have been experiencing, describing, and fighting for more than five centuries. We already see signs of ecological collapse in the overconsumption of fisheries, massive deforestation, toxic chemicals spewed across the earth and into waterways, which are the veins of Mother Earth. Indigenous peoples and the ecosystems they protect are indicators of the health of the earth, and the prognosis today is a state of crisis. Mr. Chairman, the preliminary study of the Doctrine of Discovery focuses on a very specific argument that can be traced back more than 500 years to the days of Western Christendom. It is an argument stated in a number of papal documents authorizing discovery and conquest and discovery and commerce. The argument may be expressed as follows. A Christian monarch who locates or discovers non-Christian lands and territories has the right to claim a superior and paramount title to these lands, territories, and resources. The doctrine of discovery states that non-Christian lands are considered to belong to no one because no Christians are living there and no Christian monarch or lord has yet claimed dominion. Once the claim of a right to dominion, sovereignty, and lordship was claimed by a Christian monarch, that claim was transferred to other political successors. Mr. Chairman, Francisco de Victoria was one theologian who did not agree with the view that Christian discovery could give dominion over and title to non-Christian lands. He argued that Indians had the true dominion from both a public and private law standpoint. Other thinkers arrived at the same conclusion. The issue was debated at length in the early 1550s in Spain by Sepúlveda and Bartolomé de las Casas, but no conclusive debate was arrived at. No indigenous people's representatives participated in the debate. It was a debate among Christian Europeans about indigenous peoples, and the issue was whether the Indians or indigenous peoples of the Americas were human. It was not a debate with indigenous peoples. Today, clearly, indigenous peoples have joined the debate by declaring most definitely that we are human beings. However, for more than five centuries, the doctrines of discovery and dehumanization have been institutionalized. And this is the context of the work we are doing on the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Mr. Chairman, the preliminary study focuses on the United States and points out that the doctrine of discovery was officially adopted by the United States government in an 1823 United States Supreme Court ruling known as Johnson versus McIntosh. The Johnson decision expressed and used in its deliberations the argument mentioned above, dating back to the days of Western Christendom. The U.S. Supreme Court referred to that doctrine as the principle, and I quote, that discovery gave title to the government by whose subjects or by whose authority it, the discovery, was made against all other European governments, unquote. The court explicitly referred to discovery by Christian people, notwithstanding the occupancy of the natives who were heathens. Mr. Chairman, the United States Supreme Court Chief Justice John Marshall identified the Royal Charters of Great Britain pertaining to North America as the documentary source of the argument that discovery gave title to the government by whose authority the so-called discovery was made. The Royal Charter issued to John Cabot in March 1496 was issued in imitation of earlier papal bulls. It authorized Cabot and his sons to seek out isles, countries, and regions of the heathen and infidel, which before this time have been unknown to all Christian people. This and similar language were cited as the basis for the ruling in Johnson versus McIntosh, that the United States had the ultimate dominion over Indian peoples and lands. The Johnson ruling also cited recognition of the doctrine of discovery and assertion of dominion by Spain, Portugal, France, and Holland. The ruling also mentioned the East India Company in relation to the doctrine of discovery. It should be noted that the doctrine of discovery also relates to the history of Russia. This shows the global scope of the application of the doctrine and its concomitant framework of dominance. Mr. Chairman, it is on the basis of this line of thinking that Indian land rights have been characterized in U.S. law and policy as nothing more than a permissive right of occupancy, or permission from the whites for the Indians to occupy their own lands. This was expressed by the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1955 ruling Teton Indians versus the United States, and the doctrine of discovery was referenced as recently as 2005 in the decision the City of Sherrill versus the Oneida Indian Nation of New York. A strong case can be made for the view that the critical problems and human rights violations faced by indigenous peoples are all traced to the doctrine of discovery. The State of the World's Indigenous Peoples, for example, report pinpoints key indicators of the critical conditions faced by indigenous peoples. Each and every one of the caucus statements and indigenous peoples' interventions made at the 9th session of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues provides clear documentation of the impacts of the doctrines of discovery and dominance on indigenous nations and peoples in every part of the world. Mr. Chairman, for all the above reasons, an expert group meeting on and comprehensive study of the doctrine of discovery is very much needed to investigate the global scope of the application of that doctrine as a source of the violation of the human rights of indigenous nations and peoples. A comprehensive study of the doctrine will provide the opportunity to understand that all the various struggles that indigenous peoples are engaged in are a manifestation of the same root cause, which is the claim by one people of a right of dominance over another. Mr. Chairman, Daneto, I am finished.
Señora Gonella Fritzner, gracias por compartir con nosotros el adelanto de su estudio. Yo quiero simplemente recordar, así como usted nos refirió acerca de esa decisión judicial el año de 1823 en Estados Unidos, el año de 1843 en mi país, en Bolivia, el gobierno igualmente declaró que los indígenas eran poseedores de tierras del Estado, porque el Estado generosamente les estaba dotando esas tierras, y ese fue el principio para el asalto a los territorios indígenas que se dio unos años más tarde. Y esta es una doctrina que ciertamente nos ha privado a todos los pueblos indígenas en el mundo de nuestras tierras, nuestros territorios y recursos. Y creo que es importante recordar que esta doctrina es una doctrina que viene desde el momento en que ni siquiera los colonizadores conocen nuestros países, sino viene de creencias religiosas, porque se piensa que hay una religión única y hay también un poder único, y ese poder único es el que concede tierras que ni siquiera son conocidas a unos aventureros que vienen a nuestros países y luego se hacen con el poder y luego dictan leyes que van en contra de nuestros pueblos. Es importante recordar todos esos debates del siglo XVI de los pensadores españoles, como acaba usted de señalar, Francisco de Vitoria o Ginés de Sepúlveda. Va a ser muy importante para el conjunto de los pueblos indígenas tener el estudio finalizado cuando usted lo tenga. Muchas gracias, señora Gonella Fritzner. Ayer el Foro Permanente celebró un debate sobre algunos de los informes y estudios incluidos en el tema 7 del programa de trabajo, E/C.19/2010/L.1. En la presente sesión, los oradores hablarán de los aspectos mencionados del tema 7 del programa. Me gustaría saludar a la comisionada Miri Wilson e invitar al juez Murray Sinclair, al señor Wilton Littlechild y a la comisionada Wilson a que me acompañen en el podio. El foro permanente escuchará la presentación del juez Murray Sinclair de la Comisión de la Verdad y la Reconciliación del Canadá. Doy la palabra al juez Murray Sinclair.
Is it ready?
Yeah, it's ready.
Am I on now? It's my turn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your Excellencies, expert members of the Permanent Forum, distinguished elders, ladies and gentlemen, our delegation wishes to begin by thanking and honoring the Haudenosaunee, the traditional caretakers of these territories. I'm Justice Murray Sinclair, Chairperson of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada. And I'm here with my fellow commissioners, Marie Wilson and Chief Wilton Littlechild, representing Canada's Truth Commission. Nous sommes reconnaissants d'avoir l'occasion d'être avec vous aujourd'hui pour cette importante rencontre. We are here to talk to you today about Canada's experience with boarding schools, or residential schools as we call them. We are here to talk about shaping who we are as individuals, as communities, as cultures, and as nations. We are also going to talk about the role that the international community can play in the outcome of those issues. Truth commissions have functioned with varying degrees of success around the world for many years. Those commissions have come about primarily because an act or policy of a government caused significant harm to its people, and such harm had to be acknowledged and addressed. Canada has experienced such harm for more than 150 years. During that time, Canada enforced a racist policy of assimilation against Indigenous peoples through the use of boarding schools. The belief was that Indigenous peoples were inferior and uncivilized, and with the assistance of church organizations, they could be Christianized and therefore become civilized and equal. The Canadian government stated early on that through their policy of assimilation, within a century, Indian people would cease to exist. The government targeted children, the most vulnerable. Schools became the government's vehicle to enforce this process. The thinking of the day was to kill the Indian and the child so that within a few generations, Indigenous cultures, beliefs, languages, and distinct identities would be extinguished. For roughly seven generations, nearly every Indigenous child in Canada was sent to a residential school. They were taken from their families, tribes, and communities, and forced to live in those institutions of assimilation. The results, while unintended, have been devastating. We witness it first in the loss of Indigenous languages and traditional beliefs. We see it more tragically, in the loss of parenting skills, and ironically, in unacceptably poor education results. We see the despair that results in runaway rates of suicide, family violence, substance abuse, high rates of incarceration, street gang influence, child welfare apprehensions, homelessness, poverty, and family breakdowns. Yet, while the government achieved such unintended devastation, it failed in its intended result. Indigenous people in Canada never assimilated. Avant même la fermeture du dernier pensionnat indien, au milieu des années 1990, on a pu clairement observer un résultat très important. La politique avait échoué. La culture, les traditions et les langues autochtones ont subsisté. Elles avaient été endommagées et, dans certains cas, gravement. Mais elles sont belles et bien vivantes. Through it all, Indigenous parents and communities had resisted, as best they could, this policy of assimilation and the laws that enforced it. To overcome that resistance, Canada had passed laws that denied Indigenous people the right to vote, so they could not influence lawmakers and the laws they made. It created a pass system to control their movement. It declared their traditional ceremonies illegal. It prohibited them from gathering in groups, so they could not organize protests. And it made it illegal for them or others to raise money to hire lawyers to take legal action. Prior to the schools, Indigenous communities and parents had welcomed Europeans to Canada and had shared the natural gifts of the country with them. They accepted that Europeans had much to offer, such as education in the ways of the world and literacy. They wanted their children to have those skills and that knowledge. In Western Canada, treaties were signed, and in those treaties, schools were to be provided. But the government implementation of the schools clause came with a terrible price. Children were taken forcibly and placed into schools far away from the reserves where the government had promised they would be. In many cases, Indigenous students were subjected to terrible abuse. Hundreds, if not thousands, died in the schools. Parents were not told the full extent of what was happening to their children. Visiting children at the schools was discouraged and in many places not permitted. Loneliness and fear were the Indigenous students' constant companions. In light of its growing failure and with the dawning of an awareness of what human rights should look like after the Second World War, Canada gradually restored basic human rights to Indigenous people. The pass system, prohibitions on ceremonies, the denial of access to the courts, and the denial of the right to vote all fell away. Beginning in the 1970s, the residential schools era slowly ended, with the last residential school closing in 1996. But a great wrong had been done, and the damaged and injured survivors of those schools sought redress through an increasingly enlightened Canadian court system. Canada and the churches were sued. Individuals were prosecuted for their crimes, and in some cases, finally held to account. But it was soon obvious that a court solution would take too long, be too expensive, and would impose more harm on former students, many of whom were quite elderly. In 2007, the survivors, the government, and the churches negotiated a court-approved settlement rather than continue fighting through litigation. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada was a condition of that settlement. The settlement agreement created it. It exists because the survivors wanted it. They agreed to set aside $60 million of their compensation fund for the Commission's purposes. The Commission functions with survivor money. Unlike others, it is not a government-imposed solution. It is to the courts and the parties of that agreement that the TRC is accountable. The TRC is not here to lay blame or to determine guilt. We cannot compel testimony or grant immunity. We do not decide compensation. There are others who do that. We are here to determine our future as a nation. Our first obligation is to show the true and complete story of residential schools. The history of residential schools is likely the least known dimension of Canadian history. It is not taught in our schools. It is not commemorated anywhere in our country or in our national capital. The 150-year history of residential schools has not been made a part of our national memory. It has been ignored, or worse, dismissed. What is known, however, to most Canadians is the present legacy, that Indigenous peoples in Canada do not have the same standard of life that is enjoyed by mainstream Canada. They easily fall into the trap of blaming Indigenous people for the conditions in which they live and for failing to address their problems adequately. That blaming leads inevitably to disrespect. That disrespect, however, also comes from the many generations of public policy founded on the view that white Euro-Canadians were superior, a view supported by law and taught in schools to Indigenous and non-Indigenous students alike. Mainstream Canada sees the dysfunction of Indigenous communities but have no idea how that happened, what caused it, or how government contributed to that reality through the residential school policy. They do not realize that just as Indigenous children were taught that they were inferior, so were non-Indigenous children. They do not realize that for the non-Indigenous child, this teaching had an insidious aspect. It reinforced a false belief in their own superiority. This, too, must be addressed. Most Canadians do not realize, therefore, that for there to be true reconciliation, they must be part of the solution. Education delivered through residential schools was the tool for assimilation. It was education that helped to perpetuate the situation we see today for Indigenous peoples in Canada. We at the TRC believe that it will be education again that will be the tool that best addresses all of that. For education will create knowledge, and from knowledge will come understanding. From understanding will come respect, both self-respect for Indigenous people and mutual respect for all. We are determined to tell all of Canada and the people of the world that history. We will do that through gathering and revealing the experiences of those who attended the schools, worked at the schools, or had any role in the operation of the schools. We, through the Commission, will gather statements from all of those individuals and their children who wish to tell us how that experience impacted them. And we will make that information available to everyone. That history is something that we all must teach our children and grandchildren. That history must be offered in classrooms across the country. We call for these things so that in a few generations, in place of disruption, dysfunction, and disrespect, we will see a Canada where the relationship between Indigenous Canadians and non-Indigenous Canadians is founded on mutual respect. But there is an aspect of respect that is fundamentally important. We at the Commission are aware of the degree to which the intergenerational survivors, the current children and grandchildren of survivors, hunger for more than just knowing why. We know that they also hunger for a proper sense of self. The need to assist current and future generations of Indigenous youth to find their place and purpose through cultural and language revitalization is quite apparent. Indigenous children are much more than the color of their skin. They are the products of their community, and they have the right to know what that community is. They have the right to know where they have come from, where they are going, why they are here, and who they are. The answers to such questions of life are not found in books. They are found in the experience of one's relationship with family and with friends, and in the teachings of the community to which you feel you belong. Non-Indigenous youth, by and large, have that. Indigenous youth do not. We see, therefore, that in order for there to be mutual respect for Indigenous youth, there must also be a process to help them achieve self-respect. It is an aspect of the reconciliation component of our mandate that we take very seriously. Our work is just beginning. In a few short weeks, we will meet at our first national event with residential school survivors and others who will provide statements to us. Many of these individuals will speak of their experiences for the first time. The rest of Canada will be invited to come and listen and speak of what they need to say as well. The international community has something to contribute to this process. We invite you all to participate with us and bear witness to our activities. We would like to propose that the United Nations Permanent Forum sponsor an international roundtable on truth commissions to be spearheaded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada within the next 2 years. At that roundtable, we would propose to discuss how truth commissions should impact the lives of Indigenous peoples in the world. We would also propose to discuss how truth commissions have contributed to the advancement of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We close by observing that things are changing dramatically. We point to and acknowledge the government of New Zealand for its announcement last week that it will adopt the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We point to and acknowledge the statement by the representatives of the United States of that country's willingness to review its opposition to the declaration and to consult its Indigenous peoples as it does so. We point to and acknowledge that this year, the Government of Canada stated with respect to the declaration at the start of its current parliamentary session that it will take steps to endorse this aspirational document in a manner fully consistent with Canada's constitution and laws. Nous sommes ravis de cette déclaration d'intention et attendons avec impatience le jour où elle sera mise en œuvre. The TRC encourages the establishment of an international decade of reconciliation and calls upon the members of the United Nations Permanent Forum to support this initiative. A year to reconcile such things is not enough. 5 years is not enough. A decade is only a start. Finally, the Special Rapporteur on Indigenous Peoples can count on our cooperation for any work by our Commission that the UN wishes to examine within Canada. Nous nous réjouissons à l'avance, mes collègues commissaires et moi-même, de poursuivre nos consultations avec vous dans les jours à venir. Everyone is invited to remain in this room following the morning's presentations for our side event, where we will be discussing the work of our Commission in greater detail. Thank you. Merci.
Muchas gracias, señor juez, por compartir la experiencia en el Canadá de la reconstrucción de la memoria histórica sobre una faceta que ya nuestra colega Tonia Gonella nos había adelantado respecto a las consecuencias del colonialismo y el conjunto de pueblos indígenas, en particular los de América Latina, hemos sido víctimas de lo que se ha llamado las políticas indigenistas que tenían como fin la asimilación de los pueblos indígenas, pero a través de sistemas educativos. La escuela era para nosotros esa vía de asimilación, de olvido de nuestra identidad y, por otro lado, también de los derechos. Y el ejemplo canadiense creo que puede ser muy bien emulado por los demás países para reconciliar a los habitantes de las primeras naciones, los pueblos originarios, con los que vinieron con la migración y la colonización. Le agradezco, señor juez. Seguidamente vamos a dar paso a los comentarios de nuestros colegas miembros del foro permanente. Margaret, usted tiene la palabra.
Thank you very much, Chairman. I want to appreciate the speech given by my colleague Toniela Frischner and the statement and history given by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada. Mr. Chairman, sir, dehumanization as a principle of discovery did not only affect Indigenous brothers and sisters in the continent of America. It also drastically affected indigenous peoples in Africa. Indigenous peoples' rights were seriously violated or drastically violated. This was a philosophy in the mind of the Western world, where they could come to communities and say, close your eyes, pray, while they were grabbing our land. It was an unfortunate kind of scenario. Traditional local courts are no longer recognized because of the introduction of the Western kind of culture of, you know, handling cases. And yet, our elders played a great role. Our languages, our traditional education were destroyed, and yet this were a basis of installing skills, values, and norms and identity to our people. Today, the UN DRIP stipulates the right to education, practice our traditional ways of life, and we should use as a strong advocacy instrument. It is therefore important that states ensure the inclusion of the UN DRIP in their policies and programs, in their frameworks, in different states of the world. Thank you, Chairman.
Gracias, señora Lukawa. Señor Hassan Idbel Kassan.
سيد الرئيس أود أن أعبر عن سعادتي بالاستماع إلى هذين العرضين حول أوضاع الشعوب الأصلية وعلاقة الأضرار التي حصلت لهم بنظرية الاكتشاف والتي استعملت من طرف الاستعمار الأوروبي وكذلك علاقة ذلك بالسياسات الاستيعابية التي تم تركيزها في المدارس تجاه أطفال الشعوب الأصلية والتي تؤدي إلى تدمير هوياتهم وثقافاتهم ولغاتهم بالتعليم بواسطة التعليم نفسه. وكان المفروض أن يكون التعليم وسيلة لتطوير الهوية الثقافية ولغات الشعوب الأصلية ولكن حصل العكس تماما وأود أن أهنئكم على الإنجازات التي وصلتم إليها وإن خلقوا إنشاء هذه اللجنة المتعلقة بالحقيقة والمصالحة هي دليل على تقدمكم في نضالكم من أجل حقوق الشعوب الأصلية وأعتبر أن هذا سيكون له تأثير إيجابي على كل مناطق العالم ولكن رغم ذلك أود أن أقول شيئا عن المدرسة في إفريقيا وعن المدرسة بالخصوص في شمال إفريقيا حيث إن المدرسة لعدة عقود من الزمن لم تكن تأخذ بعين الاعتبار الهويات الثقافية للشعوب الأصلية وهو ما يؤدي إلى أن المدرسة حتى ولو كان الأطفال يعيشون في عائلاتهم ولكن بمدرسة تخضع للسياسة الاستيعابية فإنها تؤدي إلى تدمير الهوية الأصلية للطفل وأود بالخصوص أن أقول عن شمال إفريقيا بأنه منذ حوالي 60 سنة أي إذا أردتم بعد الاستقلالات في شمال إفريقيا وضعت سياسات هدفها تكوين الشخصية العربية الإسلامية لشمال إفريقيا وتبين أن هذه السياسة في المدارس تؤدي إلى تدمير الهوية الأصلية للشعوب الأصلية في شمال إفريقيا وتحاول صنع هوية جديدة شعارها العروبة من أجل خلق أمة عربية في كل شمال إفريقيا والشرق الأوسط. وهذه القضية أنا عشت داخل أسرتي كطفل لا يعرف اللغات الأخرى، لا يعرف العربية ولا الفرنسية، كطفل يعرف الأمازيغية فقط، ودرست في مدرسة قريبة من أسرتي، ولكن رغم ذلك أحسست بأنني يوم دخلت المدرسة الابتدائية قطع لساني وأصبحت لا أتكلم لغة المدرسة، أتكلم لغة المنزل، وفي المدرسة أجد لغة غريبة عني، وهذا أدى إلى صعوبات في التعامل مع المدرسة. ولكن أكثر من ذلك هو أن تلك السياسة الاستيعابية في المدارس تؤدي إلى احتقار القيم الأصلية، إلى احتقار اللغة الأصلية، إلى احتقار التقاليد الأصلية، ولاعتبار أن الطفل يعتبر معلمه وأستاذه مثالا لذلك، وحينما يتكلم هو لغة من لغته الأصلية داخل القسم فإنه أحيانا يعنف توجه إليه صفعات لأنه تكلم كلمة غير اللغة الأصلية. وتابعت هذا الأمر ولكنني وعيت بهذا الشكل. وحينما فتحت مكتبي كمحام في المغرب سجلت على مكتبي كلمات باللغة الأمازيغية، وتم اعتقالي لمدة أسبوع فقط لأنني كتبت باللغة الأمازيغية في المغرب. لكن ما حدث هو أن نضال الشعوب الأصلية في أمريكا وفي العالم، وكذلك نضال الشعوب الأصلية في شمال إفريقيا، أدى كذلك إلى إعادة الاعتبار للغة الأمازيغية في المغرب والجزائر إلى آخره. وتم كذلك خلق لجنة الإنصاف، هيئة الإنصاف والمصالحة في المغرب، ولم تكن موجهة بالخصوص من أجل مواجهة المشاكل التي عانى منها الأمازيغيون، بل كانت موجهة بصفة عامة. ولكن تبين أن أغلب المناطق التي كان الناس فيها يعتقلون سياسيا، وفي حوالي 12 منطقة، هي 12 منطقة من المناطق الناطقة بالأمازيغية والتي يسكنها الأمازيغيون، وتم فعلا وضع هيئة الإنصاف والمصالحة وهي في المغرب، ولا زال هذا المسلسل يتابع بشكل ما. ومن بين نتائج هذا الإنصاف والمصالحة خلى إدماج اللغة الأمازيغية في عدد من المدارس المغربية والجزائرية. شكرا لكم، وأنا سعيد بهذا النضال الذي وصلتم إليه ووصلتم به إلى نتائج إيجابية. شكرا.
Gracias, señor Hassan Belkacem. Daremos la palabra ahora a nuestro colega Bartolomé Clavero Salvador. Señor Clavero tiene la palabra.
Muchas gracias, señor presidente. Quería reflexionar sobre el aspecto jurídico de las prácticas de educación por internado o no solo por internado y o no solo, sino también escuelas abiertas, que intentan erradicar la cultura y la lengua de la infancia y de la juventud y de la juventud indígena. Estaba recordando un libro reciente que estudia el asunto en Estados Unidos, que es el libro de Ward Churchill, que el título es Kill the Indian, Save the Man, la famosa expresión de quien fundara y organizara en los Estados Unidos este tipo de escuelas. Pero el subtítulo es El impacto genocida de las escuelas de internado, sobre el impacto genocida sobre el indio americano. Esto no es una figura de lenguaje, no es una moda de no es un modo de expresarlo, el impacto genocida. Incluso estas prácticas están tipificadas como genocidio en la Convención para la Prevención y Sanción del Delito de Genocidio, que entre los diversos supuestos que considera genocidio, pues está el traslado por fuerza de niños del grupo a otro grupo. No hace falta que se derrame una gota de sangre para que haya genocidio en este caso. Claro que cuando hace más de medio siglo se definía este supuesto de genocidio, se estaba pensando en traslados físicos, pero no hace falta en el traslado físico. Basta con que un Estado imponga un sistema de enseñanza obligatoria que solo considera la lengua y la cultura no indígena para que ese impacto genocida, que dice Churchill, se produzca, y para que se produzca, por tanto, el delito de genocidio. Yo sugiero que esto se tome en serio. Australia, Canadá están reconociendo el error de estas prácticas, que en buena parte pues ya son de un efecto irremediable. Están pidiendo incluso perdón, pero no están considerando estas prácticas como genocidio. No están llevando ante la Corte Penal Internacional para exigirles responsabilidad penal a quienes organizaron estas prácticas que todavía estén vivos. Este genocidio es equivalente en derecho internacional al, lógicamente, más sistemático, mucho más grave y de mayor alcance, al genocidio nazi. Todo el empeño se pone en aplicar a los responsables del genocidio nazi la imprescriptibilidad del genocidio y la responsabilidad penal, por lo tanto, permanente de por vida. En cambio, en estas prácticas que ya se reconocen por los Estados, pero sin que este reconocimiento conlleve el que se le considere como lo que son para el derecho penal internacional, y esto es genocidio, den lugar a que los mismos Estados denuncien ante la correspondiente jurisdicción penal internacional a quienes han cometido o a quienes han puesto en práctica estas políticas atroces contra infancia y juventud indígena. Y no solo se trata de la responsabilidad penal, se trata del derecho de las víctimas. La calificación de genocidio supone un derecho a la reparación mucho más fuerte y exigible en todo caso, aunque los responsables penales ya no estén vivos. Y esa reparación tampoco la afrontan los Estados que están reconociendo que se equivocaron en dichas políticas, etcétera, etcétera. Solo quería poner sobre la mesa esta reflexión sobre un tratamiento jurídicamente más riguroso a nivel internacional del reconocimiento de estas prácticas de políticas genocidas contra las lenguas, las culturas, las comunidades de los pueblos indígenas, no solo de las Américas. Muchas gracias.
Gracias a usted, profesor Clavero, por esta necesidad del rigor en el tratamiento jurídico. Ciertamente que para los pueblos indígenas ha sido la denuncia de esta forma de genocidio que ha dado lugar al movimiento indígena internacional. Recuerdo muy bien el contenido de las declaraciones de Barbados, donde se señala justamente cómo es que el indigenismo, a través de las políticas de asimilación y la escuela, estaba llevando a una forma de genocidio, pero generalizado en todo lo que era el continente, en todo lo que se llama Latinoamérica. Y este ha sido la base para empezar a luchar por los derechos de los pueblos indígenas. Vamos a dar la palabra a nuestro colega, señor Michael Dodson. Señor Dodson tiene la palabra.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning. Firstly, I'd like to express my deep appreciation to our colleague, Tonya Gonella-Frischner, for her report this morning on the work she's doing with this doctrine of discovery, and also express my deep appreciation to Judge Sinclair and others from the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission for your presentation. I could have almost thought that I was at home. I was involved, Mr. Chairman, during the 90s and with the what was then the Australian Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, and I was a commissioner with that commission, and we presented a report in 1998 called the Bringing Them Home Report, and it was a report about the policies and practices and laws that forcibly removed Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander kids, children from their families and communities, and had them adopted out into foster care, into institution, into church-run missions, and other placements. And this practice really didn't cease. The last laws didn't get removed from the statute books in our country until the mid-1980s. And it had a devastating effect. And to hear the judge talk about the impact of these residential schools on Canadian Aboriginal children. So I say I know that experience. Of course, we haven't had a comprehensive response to the recommendations by the Australian Human Rights Commission in its report. We're very appreciative that the federal government, under the present Prime Minister, offered an apology to the Stolen Generations for what had happened to them. And the Stolen Generations accepted that gracefully and with a great deal of dignity. But the key finding of the commission in our country was that the these policies, these practices, and the laws that were passed to enforce them were tantamount to genocide. And we based our response primarily on the the responses one would expect in international law to gross violations of human rights. And part of that involved a recommendation there be reparations. That hasn't occurred in our country at the national level. The previous federal government, the present federal government, refuses to countenance even a discussion about compensation, let alone or reparations, let alone putting together a practical response to that. I think the two things are connected. The doctrine of discovery and the forcible removal of children is... perhaps it's a way that the discoverers want to deal with our dehumanisation by seeing this as some form of humanising us in their own image. But I'm very interested in your proposals to... all three proposals. What our colleague has suggested in relation to discovery. There is a publication coming out from some Indigenous scholars later this year in Australia on this question of discovery. the idea that we further discuss this issue and actually try and get our nations to confront this and deal with it. It's not going to bring down the state, but it might bring better public policy in Indigenous affairs if we both agree and have an understanding about the issue of discovery and its impact, like the forcible removal of children from Indigenous peoples around the world. The idea of round table to discuss this I find attractive and certainly something I could endorse. And also, finally, an international decade of, I think you said reconciliation, but I would prefer to say truth and reconciliation. That's something that has some attraction to me. So, Kali, I'm done.
Gracias a usted, señor Dodson. Ahora vamos a ofrecer la palabra a nuestro colega, señor Carsten Smith, quien va a brindar informaciones sobre la decisión llevada por el Consejo Económico y Social con respecto al informe del Foro Permanente el año pasado y también informar sobre los comentarios del Foro Permanente con respecto a la Declaración de las Naciones Unidas sobre los Derechos de los Pueblos Indígenas. Señor Carsten Smith, tiene usted la palabra.
Thank you, Chair. Well, I shall, as member of the forum, say some words of information about ECOSOC's discussion of the Permanent Forum's report on the session last year, 2009. My comments relates to the annex of the report on Article 42 of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. When the Declaration was adopted by the UN General Assembly in 2007, the Permanent Forum was assigned a new function based on Article 42, including the task to follow up the effectiveness of the Declaration. The Forum considered it to be a duty to discuss the new obligations of the Forum and how the Forum can fulfill those obligations. The Forum started such a discussion in the 08 session, and ECOSOC decided to authorize an international expert group meeting on the implementation of Article 42. The meeting took place in January of 09. Following the pre-session meeting last year, a draft to a general comment to this article was presented to the forum, and in the report from the session in May of 09, paragraph 87 says, I quote, "The Permanent Forum adopts general comment number 1, 2009, entitled Article 42 of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples," unquote. In July 2009, ECOSOC discussed the forum report. Some member states made specific comments to this annex of the report. The comments had the same message, that the Permanent Forum is not a monitoring body. In its pre-session meeting March this year, the forum agreed that it is important to respond to these comments. The forum decided that four forum members would prepare a paper for this purpose. A recommendation to this effect will be included in the report of the present session of the Permanent Forum. The debate on Article 42, which is a central legal rule for the work of the forum, will probably continue and should continue. It may be essential for the future work of the forum. Thank you, Chair.
Gracias a usted, señor Carsten Smith. Vamos a abrir nuestra lista de oradores. El primer orador de nuestra lista es el señor Jean-François Tremblay, que es el viceministro de Política y Dirección Estratégica de Asuntos Indios y del Norte del Canadá. Señor Jean-François tiene la palabra.
Mr. Chairman and distinguished colleagues, good morning and thank you for this opportunity to speak. Before I begin, I would like to thank the commissioners of the Truth and Reconciliation commissions for their presence this morning, and also for their inspiring presentation, and also for raising the awareness of the comprehensive history of residential schools in Canada, across the country, and now across the world. Thank you for that. Today, I would like to provide an update of the progress made by the Government of Canada in some of the areas covered under Agenda Item 7. First, I would like to come back on this issue of the residential schools, and I would like to address the progress made with respect to the implementation of the settlement agreement that was reached to address grievances and the class action relating to Indian residential schools operated by the Government of Canada. La réconciliation et le renouvellement des partenariats avec les peuples autochtones constituent des piliers fondamentaux du plan d'action du Canada pour les autochtones. La convention de règlement relative aux pensionnats indiens signale un changement historique dans les relations entre les peuples autochtones du Canada, les églises et le gouvernement canadien. La convention constitue un excellent exemple d'une démarche honorable axée sur la collaboration pour la formulation de solutions visant aux griefs du passé. Le 11 juin 2008, le Premier ministre Stephen Harper a présenté au nom de tous les Canadiens et toutes les Canadiennes des excuses aux anciens élèves des pensionnats indiens. The apology was comprehensive and was mirrored by statements from leaders of all opposition parties in the House of Commons. Indigenous leaders were present in the House of Commons and responded. The apology recognized the suffering of students and families from the residential school system and its continuing impact on Aboriginal cultures, heritage, and community. It was well received by Indigenous leaders and many survivors, and coupled with substantive elements of the settlement agreement, indicates the sincerity of all parties to develop a new relationship. Much progress has been made on the implementation of all aspects of the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement. En date du 15 janvier 2010, le gouvernement du Canada avait reçu approximativement 99 000 demandes de paiement d'expérience commune qui visent à reconnaître l'expérience commune des résidents de pensionnats indiens. De ce nombre, 96 000 demandes ont été traitées et quelques 75 000 anciens étudiants se sont avérés admissibles au paiement pour un montant total de plus de 1,5 milliard de dollars canadiens. En vertu de l'entente, un processus d'évaluation indépendant a été établi pour régler les réclamations individuelles pour ces vices. En date du 6 décembre 2009, le secrétariat d'adjudication avait reçu près de 14 000 demandes et tenu plus de 4 500 audiences devant des arbitres indépendants. De ce nombre, près de 3 700 demandes ont été résolues. Depuis septembre 2007, près de 269 millions de dollars canadiens ont été versés aux demandeurs pour des services subis dans les pensionnats. Un calendrier a été établi pour ces audiences afin que les réclamations soient entendues rapidement. Les audiences ont lieu dans les collectivités et ou aux endroits choisis par les demandeurs. As you all know now, the key elements of the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, the TRC, that was established in June 2008. The commission is mandated to raise awareness of the comprehensive history of residential schools and provide a report and recommendations to the parties of the agreement. Importantly, the commission, as part of its work, will ensure that the statements of former students as well as anyone else affected by the Indian residential schools, are received and archived. The TRC will be hosting a first of seven national events on June 15, 2010, in Winnipeg, Manitoba. The national events are intended to engage and educate the Canadian public about the Indian residential school system. They will honor those whose lives were touched by residential schools and will also celebrate regional diversities. In concluding, or before concluding, I would like to also highlight some of Canada's recent efforts for healthier and stronger First Nations families and children. As you may know, le gouvernement du Canada offre du financement aux prestataires de services des Premières Nations, aux provinces et aux territoires du Yukon pour la livraison des services de prévention et de protection culturellement adaptés. Ceci est fait en conformité avec les lois de la province ou du territoire. Depuis quelques années, le gouvernement du Canada travaille également à la mise en place d'une nouvelle approche préventive pour la protection de l'enfance sur les réserves. Cette approche vise à éviter de séparer les familles des Premières Nations et de réduire la nécessité de prise en charge des enfants vivant sur réserve. Le gouvernement du Canada a déjà conclu des accords tripartites avec les Premières Nations et les gouvernements de cinq provinces canadiennes. Cela signifie que près de la moitié des enfants des Premières Nations du Canada sont présentement couverts par la nouvelle approche. Dans le budget de mars dernier, le gouvernement du Canada a annoncé des investissements supplémentaires afin de poursuivre la mise en place de cette approche. L'objectif du Canada est que toutes les provinces et les territoires adoptent l'approche améliorée axée sur la prévention d'ici 2013. Monsieur le Président, Mr. Chairman, as well as distinguished colleagues, as well as members of the commissions, thank you for this opportunity to provide you with this information that I hope demonstrates again Canada's continued commitment to working in partnership to build stronger Aboriginal families and communities. Thank you.
Muchas gracias, señor. Será importante para el foro permanente y para los pueblos indígenas poder contar con un resumen o un estudio que dé cuenta acerca de este proceso de reconciliación y va a servir ciertamente de un buen ejemplo para la situación o para los esfuerzos también de reconciliación en otros países. Muchas gracias. El segundo o la segunda oradora de nuestra lista es la señora Connie Taracena, de la Misión Permanente de Guatemala. Señora Taracena, tiene usted la palabra.
Muchas gracias, señor presidente. Buenos días a todos. Mi discurso va a versar sobre las políticas y proyectos de cambio climático y los pueblos indígenas. Señor presidente, Guatemala, el corazón del mundo maya en paz con la naturaleza, en el marco del proceso de negociación de la convención y en la búsqueda de un nuevo sistema climático, desea compartir su posición, la cual se fundamenta en los esfuerzos de país para la construcción de una plataforma nacional que permita reducir nuestra vulnerabilidad, mejorar nuestra adaptación y contribuir a la reducción de la emisión de gases de efecto invernadero de acuerdo con los principios de responsabilidades comunes pero diferenciadas. Esta estrategia nacional debe de estar enmarcada y apoyada por un acuerdo vinculante universal de largo plazo. De esta forma, Guatemala está trabajando en la definición e implementación de políticas, programas y proyectos sobre cambio climático orientada hacia actividades de agricultura, salud, seguridad alimentaria, infraestructura de desarrollo y la prevención de desastres, así como la gestión de riesgo. La Plataforma Nacional sobre Cambio Climático que se está construyendo cuenta ya con los siguientes componentes. Política Nacional sobre Cambio Climático. Comisión Interinstitucional sobre Cambio Climático. Iniciativa de Ley Marco sobre Cambio Climático. Elaboración de proyectos de desarrollo con énfasis en cambio climático. Una de sus principales actividades ha sido elaborar la política sobre el cambio climático a implementarse en Guatemala a través de un plan operativo. Dicha política incluye los derechos de los pueblos indígenas, de las instituciones indígenas del Estado de Guatemala. La Defensoría de la Mujer Indígena, DEMI, formó parte del segmento técnico de la delegación. Ante la preocupación de las mujeres indígenas y rurales, que son las más vulnerables ante el cambio climático, y con el objetivo de que las mujeres indígenas fueran parte de la toma de decisiones en nuestro país frente al cambio climático. Ante lo dicho, la DEMI estableció alianzas estratégicas con la Fundación Guatemala y la Mesa Indígena sobre Cambio Climático. La primera, para ampliar la red de resiliencia comunitaria y adaptación forzosa, y la segunda fue la alianza para incorporar los derechos de los pueblos indígenas en la iniciativa de ley marco sobre cambio climático. El objetivo de la política es que las instituciones incorporen en sus planes, programas y proyectos el tema del cambio climático bajo el liderazgo político del Ministerio de Ambiente y Recursos Naturales. Recomendamos asegurar la participación de las comunidades indígenas, especialmente mujeres, en la elaboración y negociación de las políticas de cambio climático para reducir su vulnerabilidad y propiciar la mejor adaptación al cambio climático para el desarrollo de los pueblos que conforman el país. Muchas gracias, señor presidente.
Gracias a usted. Nuestro próximo orador es la señora Azure Peacock del Caucus de Jóvenes de Australia. Señor Peacock tiene la palabra. ¿Está en sala? Entonces, tiene la palabra. Por favor.
How do I just press this? Sorry, Mr. Chairperson. Forests are an integral part of the Indigenous life the world over. In Australia, forests are a rich source of our cultural economy, where Indigenous people still occupy land and utilise the abundant resources for food, medicine, spiritual, cultural, social and economic purposes. Within the Indigenous estate, large areas of forests and include important handback and joint management arrangements, native title determination, Indigenous protected areas and land council holdings. The affinity and connection to forests which Indigenous peoples hold is becoming increasingly recognised in international legal instruments, while the pressure on forests through deforestation and climate change increases. These opposing forces add impetus to the better recognition of Indigenous rights and forestries through international and national law and through corporate and other approaches. Much of the forested areas are still unsustainably logged and or stressed by lack of water through poor water management, urban sprawl or mining and other development. Furthermore, Indigenous people are increasingly participating in forest management or deliver environmental services without appropriate resources and the proper rights to forested land and the resources contained within. We recommend the following. 1. That the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues urge all states, including the Australian Government, to fully implement the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and review existing legislative and administrative measures. 2. That the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues urge all states to fully protect Indigenous knowledge and cultural heritage within the forests, including fully adapting the AQUICON guidelines. 3, that the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues urge all states to ensure that the Indigenous peoples are able to fully participate in monitoring and reporting on all forested sites, including Ramsar sites and other sites that are internationally significant. 4, that the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues urge all states to comply with the Articles 27 and 28 of the Declaration by ensuring that concrete measures are taken to immediately restore Indigenous peoples' rights to their land, territories and resources. 5, that the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues urge all states to review unsustainable logging and mining and other extraction activities where Indigenous peoples' rights to lands, territories and resources exist and ensure that the rights to free, prior and informed consent are exercised. 6, that the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues urge all states to ensure that the adequate supply of water to natural forests is maintained and able to sustain the ecosystem and cultural economy, including cultural flows. And lastly, that the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues urges all states to fully protect the cultural and intellectual property of traditional knowledge systems, including access and benefit sharing, particularly those that rely on knowledge of traditional medicine, food sources and other resources within the forest. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Gracias a usted. Nuestro próximo orador es el señor Sergio Hinojosa del Consejo Nacional de Aillus y Marcas del Collasuyo. Señor Hinojosa, tiene la palabra. ¿Está en sala, señor Hinojosa?
Sí, sí, Pachi, gracias, hermano Carlos Mamani Condori. Pues un saludo fraternal a nombre del Consejo Nacional de Aillus y Marcas del Collasuyo Cunamaj, Bolivia, y también parte de del Pacto de Unidad de las 5 organizaciones matrices que lleva adelante del Estado Plurinacional Bolivia. Pues en este instante queremos hacer conocer donde se ha llevado en la ciudad de Cochabamba el Foro Mundial del Cambio Climático y la declaración de la Madre Tierra, ¿no? Donde, pues, de igual manera, queremos que se respete, ¿no? Acuerdo a lo que estamos escuchando, de que la verdad, los pueblos indígenas originarios que hemos mantenido más de 500 años de resistencia, ¿no? Y la verdad también hemos mantenido esa nuestra identidad cultural. Y de igual manera, donde en Bolivia hemos resistido en el estado colonial, donde hemos mantenido nuestra identidad cultural, que ahora a través de las luchas, de las marchas, que hemos pasado al estado plurinacional, donde la verdad tiene que ver esa descolonización, porque no ha surgido donde hemos pasado esa colonización, donde nos han impuesto a través de la colonia, del estado colonial, del neoliberalismo, donde nos han imponido esas ideas occidentales, a decir claro que no ha funcionado en Bolivia. Que hoy ahora más queremos que haya esa descolonización, donde queremos recuperar esas ideologías que hemos tenido los pueblos indígenas originarios para llevar adelante. Y también en esta instancia que sobre la declaración de la Madre Tierra, que las naciones, que el Foro Permanente de las Naciones Unidas que haga respetar. Bueno, eso sería mi palabra. Quiero agradecer, hermano Carlos Mamani, pues que lleve adelante este Foro Permanente de las Naciones Unidas. Puedo pasar, hermano Freddy Kondo. ¿No está?
Gracias a usted. Seguidamente damos la palabra al señor Kaab Malik de Pakistán. Señor Malik tiene la palabra.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, sir. Okay. with the name of the Creator, the Merciful, the Beneficent, Honorable Chair and Delegate and Chiefs, and Indigenous brothers and sisters, I greet you with a greeting of peace. I salute the Indigenous pioneer who struggled day and night to bring the permanent farm into reality. For the last 15 years, I myself witnessed upon the journey. It was difficult to reach at this stage. My special thanks to Indian Law Alliance, the courageous Tania Ganela Freshner, for her leadership. As Chief Lyon said, we could not cross the street. We used to hold meeting in church building, not in the UN. The law of the Creator keeps balance. We have to rise. The indigenous peoples are one, the language the same, the living style the same, the problem the same. Our struggle to protect Mother Earth is the same. Under Article 332, I have submitted documents on the Kalash, Indigenous and Co-People to our first president, Ole Henrik Mega. But just to update the climate change, the impact has caused glacier melt, we call it Shayos, and melted and swept away two villages, Sonor and Brep. Loss of human life, houses, land, orchards, cattle, and life and pastures destroyed. And mining the same problems. And the, in Hindu Kush, the people have only mountain. The government of NWFP leased out 700 square miles to mainland carp in Pakistan without consulting locals. Corporation, the same problem. In the Kalash tradition, custom, and the women go to a special house for their monthly. It is called Bashaleni. No male is allowed in that area. PTDC, Pakistan Tourism Development Corporation, built hotel right in front of that house, violating the privacy of the Kalash women. We need peaceful solution to save indigenous people and the Mother Earth. The Honorable Chair, and I have a three recommendation. From elementary school to high education, we have curriculum courses in all field of life. These courses are designed to be capital market oriented and focus solely on money making. With these tools, they use any means to make dollar. In result, we have gone too far to damage ourselves and Mother Earth. As an indigenous people, we have responsibility to teach a balanced life that may lead to a peace and harmony with ourselves and with Mother Earth. Mr. Chair, since the draft declaration was adopted, we shall have indigenous people flag outside the UN that represent the Mother Earth and indigenous people. This is number one. Number two, we shall introduce the compulsory course in education institution by the member countries that teach nations exalted character so that man can understand the purpose of life on this earth. I request the permanent forum, if it's possible, all the indigenous people in their respective countries shall stand peacefully in front of their parliament with a banner of exalted character that invite them to have peace with Mother Earth. Then exalted characters as follow: peacefulness, mercifulness, justice, truthfulness, love, forgiveness, respect, patience, trust, harmony, balance, honesty, fairness, tolerance, sharing, right to life, right to security, right to indigenous resources, freedom, God-fearing, pure intention, appreciation, kindness, humbleness,
Señor, ruego a usted terminar su exposición.
Courageousness, wisdom, obedience, purity, prayer, clean heart, positivity, faithfulness, loyalty, piety, values, feeling of wrongdoing, consideration, compassionate, useful, productivity. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Quiero recordarles que los temas que nos ocupan esta mañana es el informe sobre los pueblos indígenas y los internados, el estudio preliminar de las consecuencias que tiene para los pueblos indígenas la teoría jurídica internacional conocida como la doctrina del descubrimiento y el examen de cuestiones relacionadas con Beijing más 15. Ruego a los delegados referirse a estos temas. Vamos a dar la palabra a la señora Isabel Ortega, viceministra de Justicia del Estado Plurinacional de Bolivia. Señora Ortega, tiene usted la palabra.
Bueno, muchas gracias. Le agradecemos, señor presidente, y a todos los que están en la testera. Bueno, más que todo, en estos momentos, como decían, de cambio climático, y es verdad, no solamente en nuestro país, Bolivia, que en estos momentos, como en Bolivia, yo veo de que en otros países también afecta al cambio climático. Como por ejemplo, en el departamento de Oruro, Bolivia, tenemos afectado por el Inti Raymi y otras minas que se encuentran, porque hablamos de cambio climático, porque ese cambio climático, las empresas transnacionales como Inti Raymi en Bolivia, Oruro, le está afectando, porque hay ganados con dos cabezas, con cinco patas. Entonces, esos químicos que manejan no cuidan. Decimos que debe ser ecológicamente, pero sin embargo las empresas mineras no cuidan en todo Bolivia, sino no es en el departamento de Oruro nomás, sino en todo Bolivia. Eso es lo que queremos, que nosotros que cuiden y manejen ecológicamente las empresas mineras, más que todo las empresas privadas, que decimos empresa Inti Raymi, como también otras empresas que no manejen químicos, sino queremos que trabajen ecológicamente. Y también queremos decir de que hay que traen en la producción agrícola, hay empresas que traen pesticidas, fungicidas, y hace daño a las producciones. Entonces debemos también manejar a nivel mundial, no solamente en nuestro país, sino a nivel mundial deben manejar trabajos o sembradíos ecológicos para que no afecte a nuestro organismo. Muchas gracias.
Gracias, señora viceministra. El próximo orador de nuestra lista es el señor Lars Madsen, de la Misión Permanente de Dinamarca. Señor Madsen, tiene usted la palabra.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Permanent Forum Indigenous Issues, distinguished representatives of indigenous peoples from around the world, excellencies, distinguished delegates. My delegation would like to express our gratitude to the presenters of today's report, and we've listened carefully to the wise and at times very disturbing words. With your indulgence, however, we would also like to just give a brief statement on some of yesterday's reports, a study to determine whether climate change policies and projects adhere to the standards of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Recalling the appeal in the Anchorage Declaration that all RED initiatives must secure the recognition and implementation of IPR, including security of land tenure, amongst others, Denmark has taken a firm stand in connection with the support to the UN RED. RED Plus emerged as one of the points of consensus at the COP15 meeting in Copenhagen in December 2009. And the Copenhagen Accord recognized the crucial role of RED Plus and paved the way for establishing an immediate response mechanism enabling the mobilization of financial resources from the developed countries. Six developed country governments also pledged $3.5 billion in quick start finance for RED+. The UNFCCC process has yet to finalize the overall architecture and safeguard frameworks. And Denmark will do its utmost to bring the concerns of indigenous peoples forward during the future UNFCCC talks in Mexico in December 2010. Denmark has made a contribution to the UN Red, particularly emphasizing the implication of free, prior, and informed consent, as well as the standards in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We are also providing support to the Forest Carbon Partnership Facility to assist forest countries in building capacity for preparing for RED. And importantly, we are supporting the IUCN initiative seeking to involve indigenous peoples in the national governance structure of the RED in a number of pilot countries. Mr. Chairman, Denmark will continue to support the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and the rights and the principles therein that are relevant to threats to indigenous peoples posed by climate change, as referred also to in the report of the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights on the relationship between climate change and human rights. Furthermore, Denmark supports the development of a dedicated grant mechanism for indigenous peoples and local communities under the Forest Investment Programme. This dedicated mechanism will provide grants to indigenous peoples in countries or regional pilots to support the participation in the development of forest investment strategies, programs, and projects. Support will focus on, inter alia, securing and strengthening customary land tenure and resource rights and traditional forest management systems. On pilot projects proposed by indigenous peoples and on involvement of indigenous peoples in the monitoring and evaluation of forest activities. Mr. Chairman, through our bilateral programs, Denmark has worked actively with indigenous groups in Malaysia, Vietnam, Nepal, Bolivia, and Nicaragua, as well as with the pastoralists in East Africa. And we have on several occasions raised our concerns on development affecting indigenous peoples' rights. Over the coming year, we aim at increasing our support to climate change adaptation and mitigation, with a particular emphasis on vulnerable groups, including indigenous peoples. Thank you for your time.
Gracias a usted, señor. Nuestro próximo orador será el señor Luis Toro, de la Organización de los Estados Americanos. Señor Toro nos va a comentar sobre el proceso que lleva la Declaración Americana sobre los Derechos de los Pueblos Indígenas. Tiene la palabra, señor Toro.
Muchas gracias, señor presidente. Quiero aprovechar esta oportunidad para hacer una breve reseña del trabajo que realiza la OEA, órgano regional de las Naciones Unidas, en relación a la protección y difusión de los derechos de los pueblos indígenas de las Américas. Les recuerdo que no hemos tenido la oportunidad de participar en este foro desde el año 2006. Voy a analizar cuatro puntos particulares. Mandatos de la Asamblea General. Actualmente la OEA se encuentra negociando un proyecto de declaración americana sobre los derechos de los pueblos indígenas. Para tal efecto se ha creado un grupo de trabajo en el seno de la Comisión de Asuntos Jurídicos y Políticos del Consejo Permanente. En las discusiones y sesiones de negociación participan representantes de los estados y representantes de los pueblos indígenas. La más reciente reunión de negociación para la búsqueda de consenso se celebró en noviembre, entre el 30 de noviembre y 2 de diciembre de 2009 en Washington, D.C., y fue precedida por una reunión del cónclave de representantes indígenas que tuvo lugar del 27 al 29 de noviembre. Al presente, el grupo de trabajo ha celebrado un total de 11 reuniones de negociaciones para la búsqueda de consenso. El documento de referencia es el registro del estado actual. Dicho documento está compuesto de 41 provisiones organizadas en 6 secciones, de las cuales 9 han sido consensuadas y 10 aprobadas. Contiene también un preámbulo que al día de hoy no ha sido objeto de revisión. Vale la pena mencionar que la adopción por parte de la ONU de la declaración ha obligado al grupo de trabajo a discutir sobre el impacto del instrumento universal en relación al proyecto de declaración de la OEA. El próximo mes de junio, la Asamblea General de la OEA, nuestra máxima órgano, reunida en Lima, Perú, celebrará su 40º periodo ordinario de sesiones y adoptará una nueva resolución para dar continuidad al mandato del grupo de trabajo encargado de la adopción de la Declaración Americana sobre los Derechos de los Pueblos Indígenas. La celebración de nuevas reuniones de negociaciones permitirá continuar la discusión de las provisiones pendientes del registro del Estado actual. Quiero aprovechar esta oportunidad para agradecer a los gobiernos de España, México y Nicaragua, cuyo financiamiento al fondo específico ha permitido la participación de por lo menos un representante indígena por país en las sesiones de negociación. 2. Iniciativa de la Secretaría General. Por estos días, 4 áreas de la Secretaría General de la OEA están organizando un seminario de líderes indígenas en Washington, D.C., para presentar mecanismos de participación de los pueblos indígenas en las actividades de la OEA, de modo a enriquecer el conocimiento de los mismos y estimular un diálogo que permita una mejor profundización e integración. El evento se celebrará en Washington, D.C. el 23 y 24 de junio. En la oportunidad, todas las dependencias involucradas en el tema presentarán diversas formas de participación. Entre las entidades involucradas, contaremos con las presentaciones de la Comisión Interamericana de Derechos Humanos, la Secretaría de Cumbre de las Américas, el Departamento de Relaciones Internacionales y el Departamento de Derecho Internacional que yo represento, encargado de actividades de facilitación de la participación de los pueblos indígenas descritas en el punto anterior. De igual manera, esperamos la presencia de representantes y líderes indígenas de las Américas, por lo menos un representante por país, los cuales deberán presentar una ponencia sobre las formas de participación que una organización internacional de la naturaleza de la OEA debería permitir. También contaremos con la presencia de un representante del Fondo Indígena para América Latina y el Caribe, del ILSA, y aprovecho esta oportunidad por su intermedio, señor presidente, para solicitarle la designación de un representante del Foro Permanente sobre Cuestiones Indígenas de la ONU para que asista al seminario y pueda explicar las formas de participación en el seno de esta instancia. Al finalizar el evento, presentaremos un documento que espero poder compartir con ustedes el próximo año. Programa de acción. El Departamento de Derecho Internacional se ha dotado de un programa de acción sobre los pueblos indígenas con el objetivo de promover y fortalecer la participación de los pueblos indígenas en los distintos procesos internos e internacionales de toma de decisión, sensibilizar a la sociedad en general sobre esta temática y capacitar a los representantes de los pueblos indígenas en diversas áreas para permitir un desarrollo integral de sus comunidades y transversalizar la temática indígena en diversos proyectos de la OEA. El programa está orientado a miembros de los pueblos indígenas y organizaciones indígenas, puesto que se espera poder incidir en las comunidades de base, además de poder alcanzar un efecto multiplicador de las actividades propuestas. En este contexto, y gracias al financiamiento del Gobierno de Alemania y de la Agencia de Desarrollo de Alemania, el Departamento ha podido desarrollar las siguientes actividades. Actividades de capacitación. Al presente se han desarrollado 2 eventos de capacitación sobre el buen gobierno y el sistema interamericano, un curso de buen gobierno y un taller de marco lógico celebrado en la ciudad de Panamá entre el 9 y el 14 de noviembre del 2009, y el más reciente fue un seminario de capacitación sobre los derechos de los pueblos indígenas en el sistema interamericano, promoción y protección de los derechos humanos en Bogotá, Colombia, en diciembre del 2009. El Departamento apoya un proceso de transversalización de la perspectiva indígena en los programas y proyectos y actividades de la OEA. Para tal fin, pretendemos elaborar una guía práctica para los funcionarios de la Secretaría General. En este sentido, señor presidente, sería interesante poder conocer si en la Secretaría del Foro existen algunas experiencias en la materia. Otras actividades. El programa de acción, existen varias otras actividades que todavía no han encontrado un financiamiento. Y en este dominio proponemos, por ejemplo, la elaboración de programas de asistencia jurídica para las personas indígenas privadas de libertad y las personas indígenas desplazadas internamente o migrantes. Finalmente, quiero expresar una invitación general a los líderes indígenas de las Américas que asisten al foro y que no conocen o que no han podido implicarse en la OEA, se acerquen ya sea a mi persona o me remitan los datos a través del siguiente correo dil@oas.org, lo repito, dil@oas.org. Le agradezco, señor presidente, por la oportunidad y por la atención.
Muchas gracias, señor Toro, por la información respecto al proceso que lleva la Declaración Americana sobre los Derechos de los Pueblos Indígenas. Y gracias por la invitación al seminario en el mes de junio sobre participación indígena. El foro va a enviar su representante. Asimismo, muchas gracias por la invitación. Asimismo, decirle que el foro permanente y especialmente su secretaría está trabajando en procesos de capacitación tanto de líderes indígenas como también de funcionarios de los equipos país de Naciones Unidas y funcionarios del gobierno. Entonces, va a ser muy importante que usted y la secretaría puedan hacer un intercambio más particularizado sobre este asunto. Gracias, señor Toro. Una recomendación, me dicen acá de la secretaría, es que para efectos de traducción podamos tener una intervención un poco más, más calmada, hablar más lentamente. Esa recomendación, por favor. Vamos a seguir con nuestra lista de oradores. Nuestra próxima oradora es la señora Mónica Alemán, del Foro Internacional de Mujeres Indígenas. Señora Mónica Alemán, tiene usted la palabra. Señora Alemán, ¿está en sala? Entonces, damos la palabra a la señora Ellen Gabriel, de las mujeres autóctonas de Quebec. Señora Gabriel, tiene la palabra. Tiene la palabra, señora.
Matkunwaradus, greetings, my relations. Gender equality is virtually non-existent for Indigenous women in Canada due to the paternalistic nature of its antiquated Indian Act. Canada's refusal to embark on a genuine post-colonial process hinders women's full and effective participation in decision-making processes that seriously affect their rights, as outlined in Articles 18 and 19 of the UN Declaration. Human rights instruments in Canada do not provide sufficient protection from systemic discrimination, causing Indigenous women to be one of the most vulnerable groups in Canadian society. The double discrimination experienced by Indigenous women in Canada seriously impedes the rights affirmed by the United Nations Declarations on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples to freely determine their political status and freely pursue their economic, social, and cultural development. On March 11th, 2010, motivated by a court order from the Court of Appeal for British Columbia, the Government of Canada introduced Bill C-3, an act to promote gender equity in Indian registration, in an attempt to end gender discrimination found within the Indian Status Registration Regime, Section 6 of the Indian Act. However, Bill C-3 will not end gender discrimination. Bill C-3 does not recognize the fundamental rights of Indigenous peoples and nations as supported in international human rights law to defend their own nationality, identity, and citizenship. The promotion of gender equality is vital to the self-determination of Indigenous peoples. Indigenous languages, culture, customary laws have been devastated by imperialism, colonization, papal bulls decreeing the doctrine of discovery, and the residential school system. Canada continues to impose the dominant culture's language and values while Indigenous peoples struggle for survival. On-reserve schools lag far behind Canada's education system. As evidenced in the Auditor General 2009 report, it will take 28 years for Indigenous community schools to be at an adequate level. And although Canada officially apologized for the residential school system, and in spite of the creation of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, there are no significant signs of reconciliation. The damage has been done, and it will take decades for the languages, educational institutions, and culture of Indigenous peoples to recover from the devastating impacts of the Indian Act and the residential school. Systemic discrimination leads to the feminization of poverty and exacerbates Indigenous women's marginalization as the poorest sector of the population in Canada. According to recent studies, it will take 63 years for Indigenous peoples to attain the same level of income as the rest of the population. The Government of Canada must recognize the role of Indigenous women in the development and well-being of Indigenous communities. And while we acknowledge that Canada is considering endorsing the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, we recommend that the UN Permanent Forum call upon Canada to fully endorse and implement the UN DRIP in an unqualified manner, as it is the first international instrument to address the issue of double discrimination, to begin effective consultations in good faith with Indigenous peoples on how they intend to implement the UN DRIP, to implement Article 3 of the UN DRIP, recognizing the inherent right of Indigenous peoples to define their own political status, to freely pursue their economic, social, and cultural development, allowing Indigenous peoples to move positively forward towards self-determination, to implement Article 32 on lands and resources, thereby harmonizing their current land claims process, which is biased and requires the ceding of Indigenous rights to lands and its resources to comply with the minimum standards conveyed in the UN DRIP, to eradicate all forms of gender discrimination in its administrative and legislative policies, to eliminate all assimilation policies that further exacerbate the economic disparities between Indigenous peoples and the rest of the population, and to adequately fund Indigenous communities' education systems and their efforts to protect and perpetuate Indigenous languages equivalent to the two official languages of Canada. Thank you very much.
Muchas gracias. Damos la palabra ahora a nuestro colega, señor Bartolomé Clavero. Señor Clavero, tiene la palabra.
Muchas gracias, señor presidente. Quería comentar la presencia y la intervención, la participación de la Organización de Estados Americanos, porque es importante que también las organizaciones internacionales regionales de regiones donde hay pueblos indígenas, pues participen en el foro y contribuyan a las sesiones del foro. Precisamente estos días comentábamos los miembros del foro el interés de que también pudiera participar la Unión Africana y en particular nos gustaría animar a la Comisión Africana de Derechos Humanos y de los Pueblos, sobre todo porque ya comenzaba a tomar en cuenta el derecho internacional de los derechos de los pueblos indígenas, lo cual en la última década el sistema interamericano de derechos humanos pues ha más que tomado en cuenta, está realmente desarrollando ese derecho internacional a nivel regional, hasta el punto incluso de que, según la Corte Interamericana de Derechos Humanos, el procedimiento de consulta no se vincula necesariamente al Convenio 169 de la Organización Internacional del Trabajo, sino que todos los Estados americanos hayan ratificado no ese convenio, están obligados, según la Corte, a respetar el derecho al territorio de los pueblos indígenas y, por lo tanto, a no acceder a sus recursos ni contar con ellos si no es a través del procedimiento de consulta. Ya también está atendiendo a que ese procedimiento se refuerza con la Declaración sobre los Derechos de los Pueblos Indígenas en términos de consentimiento libre, previo e informado. Viniendo ya a algunas cuestiones más concretas y procurando ser breve, me gustaría saber hasta qué punto el cambio de posición respecto a la Declaración sobre los Derechos de los Pueblos Indígenas en las Américas, primero de Colombia y ahora también el anuncio de ese cambio por parte de los Estados Unidos y Canadá, está permitiendo un impulso de ese interminable proyecto de Declaración Americana de los Derechos de los Pueblos Indígenas, porque algunos de esos estados habían intentado aprovechar la Declaración Americana para rebajar el estándar de la Declaración de Naciones Unidas. Si esos intentos de rebajar el estándar para América se han ya superado con estos cambios de postura y, por lo tanto, la declaración ya se está preparando bajo los términos indeclinables de que el estándar mínimo respecto a pueblos indígenas en las Américas es el estándar marcado por la Declaración de Naciones Unidas. En el informe de la Organización de Estados Americanos he echado en falta, pero también tiene que deberse a los apuros de tiempo, una mayor referencia a lo que al fin y al cabo es parte de la Organización de Estados Americanos, que es el Sistema Interamericano de Derechos Humanos. Tanto la Comisión como la Corte en los últimos 10 años han avanzado muchísimo en la recepción y aplicación del derecho internacional de los pueblos indígenas al caso de las Américas, en un estado o en otro también, según se acepte o no la jurisdicción de la Corte, pero la misma Comisión está muy activa en este terreno. En esta reunión del foro hemos apreciado muy especialmente el informe que la Comisión ha publicado recientemente sobre Bolivia, porque nos fortalecemos mutuamente, incide en las cuestiones que también motivaron la visita de una misión del foro permanente respecto a comunidades cautivas y a trabajo forzoso en el Chaco. Y es un informe muy detallado y muy preciso que recomendamos o que recomendaremos que se tenga en cuenta por parte del gobierno boliviano y de todas las partes implicadas en esas prácticas nefandas de trabajo forzoso y cautiverio o cautividad de comunidades. Finalmente, le indico que la colaboración entre el Foro Permanente y la Comisión Interamericana de Derechos Humanos y los seminarios que organiza la Comisión ya ha comenzado. En concreto, la Comisión, no sé si ya lo ha publicado, pero tiene que ser recientemente, estaba ultimando un informe sobre las prácticas de consulta en los diversos estados de las Américas. El último seminario que se hizo hace algo más de un año en Washington, en ese seminario, fui invitado, estuve presente, también contribuyó el relator especial, James Anaya, y me parece bien la sugerencia de que sigamos con esas prácticas de cooperación. Nada más, muchas gracias.
Gracias a usted por resaltar la cooperación con la Organización de Estados Americanos y la necesidad de contar con la presencia de organismos similares del África y otros continentes donde existen pueblos indígenas. Daremos la palabra a nuestra colega Tonia Gonella. Señora Gonella, tiene la palabra.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and I'd like to thank all of the participants today for their excellent contribution to the dialogue and discussion we've been having. And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a comment on climate change, if I may, and this has to do with the recent World People's Conference on Climate Change and the Rights of Mother Earth that just was held in Bolivia about a week ago. As you know, there were over 35,000 people in attendance, and the majority of the attendees, a large majority, were indigenous peoples. On the matters of the rights of Mother Earth, the People's Accord that came out of that gathering rejected the carbon market and carbon offset initiatives such as RED and RED Plus that have become more profit-making enterprises, really commodifying Mother Earth and privatizing forests and not a true alternative towards combating climate change. And I wanted to bring that to the attention of the attendees here. Since the conference was going on the same time as the permanent forum. In light of the recent financial crisis, which was explained so brilliantly yesterday by our colleague Victoria, that recent financial crisis has demonstrated that the market is really not very capable of regulating the financial systems. Therefore, I think it would be irresponsible to leave the care and protection of the very existence of humanity and Mother Earth in the hands of the financial markets. That's all I have to say. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Gracias a usted. Vamos a proseguir con nuestra lista de oradores. Daremos la palabra al señor Carlos Samara, viceministro de Asuntos Indígenas de Venezuela. Señor Samara, tiene usted la palabra.
Sí, muy buenos días. Quiero saludar de parte del gobierno de Venezuela a todo el foro permanente, su directiva, a todas las comunidades indígenas del mundo, a todos los delegados gubernamentales. Quería referirme en cuanto al tema del día de hoy, pero también los temas anteriores que se han discutido en cuanto a la participación de los pueblos indígenas en el marco de la constitucionalidad, en el marco de su propia sobrevivencia y su propia vivencia dentro de sus espacios territoriales en Venezuela y en el marco del inicio de la nueva independencia por parte de los pueblos indígenas en nuestro país. Durante el año 2009 y 2010, la participación de los pueblos indígenas en los procesos de inclusión que impulsa el gobierno revolucionario de la República Bolivariana de Venezuela, liderizado por el comandante presidente Hugo Rafael Chávez Frías en materia social, político y económico, de acuerdo al plan de desarrollo del país que establece la activación del poder comunal, del poder popular, en la toma de decisiones que enrumban el destino del país, que busca las garantías de la suma de felicidad posible a los venezolanos, han sido notorios para demostrar al mundo que vivimos en un país donde las voces de los humildes son tomados en cuenta y que de ella es la esencia del desarrollo humano de nuestras sociedades. Es importante resaltar que los avances en materia de los pueblos indígenas lo hacen los propios pueblos indígenas, ya que es necesario profundizar el sistema de vivencia colectiva de los pueblos indígenas como eje fundamental de la construcción del socialismo siglo XXI. Por tanto, se le ha otorgado a los pueblos escribir su propia historia, que es sin duda la historia del pueblo venezolano. Es interesante recalcar cómo los pueblos indígenas planteamos ante la institucionalidad del Estado, del gobierno revolucionario, propuestas en materia de la conservación del medio ambiente, la preservación de las mismas como garantías de la vida y la salvación de la especie humana en el mundo. Por su parte, el gobierno revolucionario busca y activa mecanismos la implementación de la exigencia de los pueblos. Queridos hermanos, con la propuesta de descolonizar la educación, con el tema del descubrimiento de nuestras tierras, con el tema de la conquista de nuestras tierras, siempre estuvieron presentes para dejar y limitarnos a un solo concepto. Pero proponemos la descolonización de la educación y de ella conceptos y definiciones del mundo capitalista a conceptos de reavivamiento y visibilización, revitalización del buen vivir comunitario planteado por el movimiento indígena en Indo-Afro-Latina, que es más que buscar equilibrios de nuestra madre tierra, reconstituyendo lo destruido por el interés capitalista de los grandes transnacionales consecuentes de la tragedia de muchos pueblos en el mundo. La recuperación de los valores culturales de los pueblos, el caminar de la palabra, la sabiduría de nuestros ancestros, son conceptos en el acontecimiento actual de los pueblos indígenas en América Latina y el mundo, que bien lo profundizamos desde la Alianza Bolivariana para los Pueblos de Nuestra América, desde Bolivia, Venezuela, Ecuador y otros países miembros. A ella se debe fijar las miradas de los supuestos países desarrollados, quienes son de alguna manera consecuentes de la pérdida del sentimiento humanista y la pérdida de la vivencia de los seres humanos. Las propuestas del movimiento indígena en el mundo deben ser escuchadas y tomadas como alternativas para salvar el mundo sin condiciones alguna, porque sabemos que hay muchas fuentes cooperantes provenientes de las telías de los destructores del mundo
tomando del movimiento indígena un trampolín para justificar sus desastres a través de proyectos de cooperación sobre diversidad, biodiversidad, conservación del medio ambiente y nuestras Amazonas, poniendo limitaciones y condiciones en la ejecución de las mismas. Debe terminar el colonialismo financiero y capitalista en el mundo. ¿Y qué hemos hecho y estamos haciendo desde Venezuela, buscando la suprema felicidad posible a nuestros pueblos, a través de políticas que son construidas por ellas mismas, dándole poder a los actores de sociedad que es el pueblo mismo, facilitando las herramientas necesarias para que avancen la consolidación de sus derechos que le fueron de alguna manera negadas por muchos años, que hoy revitalizando y visibilizando sus propios sistemas de educación, sus propios sistemas de medicina originaria, formas de organización política social que fundamenta el nuevo modelo de país que queremos en Venezuela. Por tales motivos, nuestra Venezuela querida, tierra de Guaycaipuro y de nuestros libertadores, nosotros, pueblo hecho gobierno y gobierno hecho pueblo, decimos que es necesario que todos los países del mundo y sus gobernantes escuchemos la voz de nuestros pueblos y construyamos con ellas el verdadero espacio de convivencia o el buen vivir comunitario. Basta de imposiciones, basta de incumplimiento de acuerdos y normas internacionales por parte de los poderosos. Construyamos un mundo sin diferencias. No más intimidaciones, no más saboteos a los países que queremos ser libres. Pueblos del mundo, defendemos nuestra soberanía de nuestros pueblos. Muchas gracias.
Gracias, señor viceministro. Nuestro próximo orador de la lista es el señor Umaru Hindo del Caucus del África. Señor Hindo, tiene la palabra.
Merci, monsieur le président, de nous avoir donné la parole. Je tiens à vous rappeler que depuis le jeudi passé, les organisations autochtones africaines, les caucus africains, on s'est inscrit à plusieurs fois pour avoir la parole sur des différents thèmes, mais malheureusement, on n'a pas eu la chance jusqu'à... Nous sommes désolés d'avoir monté sur le podium tout à l'heure pour revendiquer encore. Mais comme on a plusieurs déclarations, on ne peut pas les faire. Vous avez donné seulement une parole. Donc, je laisse la parole à Saoudata pour faire juste la déclaration qu'on considère beaucoup plus importante pour nous.
Thank you. 28 indigenous leaders from Africa, from 15 countries from Africa, gathered in Bamako, Mali, to develop a strategy and action plan for the implementation of the United Nations Declaration on the Human Rights. The workshop was organized by Indigenous People of Africa Coordinating Committee, IPAC, and hosted by Tinhinan Nomadic Women Association. It was opened by the representative of the Malian Minister of Justice and closed by the High Council of Territories, Communities of the Republic of Mali. The Malian state representative welcomed, delegated, and emphasized the importance of reinforcement human rights institutions and practice on African continent with particular attention to redressing the marginalization of indigenous people. The meeting had two major focused items: exploring the relationship between the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights, UNDRIP, and the African Charter on Human Rights and People, and secondly, studying issues of the human rights both at the African and international level. Principal guideline. The delegate made following observation on this meeting. The rights of indigenous peoples in Africa will only be effectively protected through the reinforcement of independent expert human rights body. Excuse me. Human rights body The rights of indigenous people in Africa will only be effectively protected through the reinforcement of independent expert human rights body at national level, a free and responsible media, and dynamic, independent, and well-organized civil society able to monitor and work with African government on achieving human rights legislation, institution practice, and effective monitoring. Human rights are closely tied to effective democracy, good governance, and system of check and balance nationally and through the African region treaty system and the United Nations. Indigenous people must be given stewardship over their natural resources and the right to be involved in decision-making regarding the management of their natural resources, ecosystem, and territories. IPAC members believe that the elimination of discrimination against women has stand as a core value within indigenous organizations and communities in Africa. IPAC recognizes the African Commission on Human Rights and Peoples as the most important instrument in Africa for ensuring implementation of human rights declaration on indigenous people in the framework of African Charter. Indigenous people rights do not stand alone. The African Commission on Human Rights and People Rights remains most important instrument in Africa for ensuring implementation of the Human Rights Declaration in the framework of the African Charter. IPAC has made the following commitment at the Bamako Conference. The promotion of the UN Declaration on Rights of Indigenous People at local level with indigenous people, with a national government, with National Human Rights Commission, with traditional leaders, with African Commission on Human Rights People and its expert working group and other actors in the development issues in our countries. IPAC will work closely with the African Commission to submit shadow report on human rights, promote mission to African community, and to lobby for the creation of the post of a special rapporteur on human rights of indigenous people in Africa. They will work with its members to train indigenous leaders, civil society, NGO, human rights defenders, lawyers, and human rights officials in the legal and conceptual aspect of the Human Rights Declaration on Indigenous People and the level article of African Charter on Human Rights and People Rights. IPAC commits to inform and build capacity of indigenous leaders and communities about the international standard with regard to women's rights and elimination of gender-based discrimination of rights violation. IPAC affirmed that if indigenous people are to benefit from international and regional standard and norm, then this must be made equality accessibility to indigenous women. The Bamako Conference noted that culture and traditional are dynamic. Valuable tradition need to be safeguarded with harmful tradition, including female genital mutilation need to be stopped or transformed by the community in compliance with the law. And please, I will make recommendation. Okay, I come to recommendation. Excuse me. Delegate emphasized that the decision in 2003 by the African Commission on Human Rights People to recognize indigenous people has been a major step forward, but most governments don't have a plan for implementing UN declaration, even though they voted in favor. Progress has been made only in four countries in Africa. Indigenous people are looking for new strategy to promote human rights and fundamental freedom in Africa. All sub-region and national delegates emphasize the importance of training and capacity building, like building alliance in the civil society, notably also including local leaders, traditional authorities, women organizations, develop advocacy capacity for national lobbying and action, link indigenous rights to the theme of good governance and democracy in the countries. Before I end my intervention, I want to share with you that in the Sahel country, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, pastoralists are affected by consequences of climate change and are facing serious food security crises. I will speak in French. Nous appelons les États concernés, les donateurs, les agences des Nations Unies à trouver des solutions urgentes et durables en respectant la participation des peuples autochtones telles que assurées dans la déclaration sur les droits des peuples autochtones et autres mesures prises par les Nations Unies. Nous demandons aux autorités américaines et canadiennes d'être plus souples pour nous faciliter l'obtention des visas afin de nous permettre de participer aux sessions de l'instance permanente, CBD et autres activités dans le cadre de nos mandats, parce qu'actuellement, on a beaucoup de participants qui sont restés là-bas à cause des problèmes de visa. Je vous remercie pour votre diligence.
Gracias, señora Saudata. Seguimos con nuestra lista de oradores. El próximo orador de nuestra lista es el señor Tau
Niño,
de la misión permanente de China. Señor Niño, tiene la palabra.
Señor Niño, 同时，我也想对上届会议主席科尔普斯女士的出色工作表示感谢。中国代表团愿与论坛专家和各国代表一道努力，推动本届会议取得积极成果。 主席先生，中国代表团赞赏有关专家为起草土著人民与技术制教育报告所做的努力。需要指出的是，报告有关中国少数民族技术制教育的内容、观点和论据成就。 既不符合事实，也未能正确反映新中国成立后，特别是改革开放以来，中国少数民族教育事业的发展成就。中方此前已就此 专门致函论坛秘书处明确表达关切，这里就不再重复。主席先生，中国政府高度重视少数民族和民族地区的教育事业发展。新中国成立后， 特别是实行改革开放以来，中国民族地区教育事业取得了前所未有的长足发展，基础教育不断加强，职业教育、成人教育、高等教育全面推进。 第五次全国人口普查表明，朝鲜、满、蒙古、哈萨克等14个少数民族的受教育年限高于全国平均水平。目前，55个少数民族都有自己的大学生。维吾尔、回、朝鲜、纳西等10几个少数民族的每万人平均拥有的大学生数已超出全国平均水平。为解决少数民族农牧区、边远山区和边疆地区学龄儿童上学难的问题，国家在部分省区创办技术制民族中小学，调配优秀教师，加强师资力量，加大对校舍和教学设备的投入，目前中国共有技术制民族中小学6000余所，技术制民族中小学对提高当地学龄儿童入学率和巩固率，集中有限师资力量提高办学水平，发挥了重要作用。已成为中国特色民族教育的一种重要办学形式。中国政府将继续坚持从各民族地区的实际出发，加大扶持力度，进一步完善少数民族人才培养和支持民族地区教育发展的特殊政策措施，促进民族地区教育事业协调发展。谢谢主席先生。
Gracias a usted, señor. Daremos la palabra a nuestra colega, señora Victoria Tauli Corpus. Señora Tauli tiene la palabra.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I would like to take the floor this time to just clarify some of the earlier statements made by my distinguished colleague, Tonya Gunilla Frischner. With due respect to Tonya, I would just like to clarify that, first of all, the statement that you are referring to, which was made in Cochabamba, is a statement that was not approved by the whole Cochabamba Conference. It's a statement that was released by the Working Group on Forests, which is a working group mainly composed of NGOs working in forests and a few indigenous organizations. The Indigenous People's Declaration, which came out from the Indigenous Working Group 7, clearly didn't mention anything about rejecting RED or RED Plus. I'd just like to clarify that, because the status of statements that are being presented here, which make it appear as if this is the whole statement that came from the conference, is, I think, a misrepresentation of what has taken place in Cochabamba. The second point I'd like to raise is that the Indigenous People's Caucus, who were attending all the negotiations of the Framework Convention on Climate Change, have been discussing for many, many years all these issues related to climate change and forests. And in the final statement of the Indigenous Peoples in Copenhagen, which is the International Indigenous Peoples Forum on Climate Change, the Indigenous Peoples clearly said that there was no statement to that effect. In fact, there was a discussion among all the regional caucuses to look at this issue, and there was no consensus reached because most of the regional caucuses, did not agree to that. And this brings me to my second to the last point, that I think when we make these kinds of statements, first of all, we have to remember that RED, reduced emissions from deforestation and degradation, is an issue that is very much related, an issue that is directly concerned that is of a direct concern to indigenous peoples in tropical rainforests in developing countries. And indigenous peoples in tropical rainforests have to make the decisions on how they will deal with the issue of RED. And this has been discussed in the permanent forum session 2 years ago, and we all agreed that the right to self-determination of indigenous peoples should be respected unconditionally, and they are the ones who have to make the decisions in relation to how to look at this whole RED issue and how to engage with it. I just want to make the clarification because tomorrow we are going to have a half-day half-day session on forest, and I hope that kind of misrepresentation doesn't come into the floor again, because we have to be clear. When you say it's made in Cochabamba, you have to clarify that it's the working group on forest, of which only a few indigenous peoples were there. The indigenous people statement clearly didn't mention anything along those lines. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Gracias, señora Tauli Corpus. Mañana seguramente en la agenda, cuando toquemos el tema dedicado a bosques, nos presentarán las conclusiones de Cochabamba y sabremos entonces cuáles han sido las conclusiones de las distintas mesas de trabajo. Damos la palabra a representante de la Santa Sede, el señor Curia José. Señor José, tiene la palabra.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for giving my delegation the floor. My delegation takes this opportunity to reply to some of the comments and concerns made this morning. Regarding the question of the doctrine of discovery and the role of the papal bull Inder Chetra, the Holy See notes that Inder Chetra as a source of international law, the division of lands between Castile, Aragon, Spain, and Portugal was first of all abrogated by the Treaty of Tordesillas in 1494, and that circumstances have changed so much that to attribute any juridical value to such a document seems completely out of place. Similarly, as a source of canon or church law, since the document has called for excommunication late sententiae, those who do not respect its dispositions in the Chetra has also been abrogated by the facts, first and foremost by the unsanctioned immediate expansion of the territory of Brazil to the west, well beyond the Treaty of Tordesillas, and by the colonization of North America and the Caribbean by the King of France. In addition, it was also abrogated by other papal bulls, for example, Sublimis Deus in 1537, which states, Indians and all other people who may later be discovered by Christians are by no means to be deprived of their liberty and the possession of their property, even though they may be outside the faith of Jesus Christ, and that they may and should freely and legitimately enjoy their liberty and the possession of their property, nor should they be in any way enslaved. Should the contrary happen, it shall be null and have no effect. This view was expanded upon and reinforced in Immensa Pastorum of Benedict XVI, of December 1741, and a number of other papal encyclicals, statements, and decrees. If any doubt remains, it is abrogated by Canon 6 of Code of Canon Law of 1983, which abrogates in general all preceding penal and disciplinary laws. As you may gather from the above, this abrogation process took place over the centuries according to the legal maxim, lex posterior derogat priori. That is, a subsequent law imports the abolition of a previous one. Therefore, for international law and for the Catholic Church law, the bull Indra Chetra is a historic remnant with no juridical, moral, and doctrinal value. Further, the doctrine of the temporal power of the papacy upon which Indra Chetra rests was finally overturned by the Second Vatican Council. Finally, Mr. Chairman, the doctrine of forced conversion of non-Christians was contested and changed by the Junta Theologica de Valladolid not long after the bull of Alexander VI and was also condemned by the Second Vatican Council. Further, the assertion that wars of conquest are justifiable in order to convert non-Christians was completely overturned by the documents of the Second Vatican and by the general condemnations of war. The fact that juridical systems may employ the doctrine of discovery as a juridical precedent is therefore now a characteristic of the laws of those states and is independent of the fact that for the Church the document has had no value whatsoever for centuries. The refutation of this doctrine is therefore now under the competence of national authorities, legislators, lawyers, and legal historians. Mr. Chairman, regarding the concerns and comments raised this against the educational programs of the Church and its boarding schools in different parts of the world, my delegation would like to clarify that the ultimate objective of the Church was to offer the indigenous population improved education. Most of the leaders of such communities were formed in such education centers and are grateful for the services that received from the Church. Education is the key to development, especially when different models of development are being imposed and experimented on the indigenous communities without respect for the indigenous culture and identity. The Holy See recognizes the right of indigenous peoples for education, for development, and their traditional beliefs. For the shortcomings and mistakes, the Church has sought always means of dialogue and reconciliation. Last year, for example, when Pope Benedict XVI received the representatives of the First Nation in Canada, this issue was discussed. In addition, in a number of meetings and discussions with indigenous peoples from around the world, Pope John Paul II also reiterated the Holy See's support for the rights of the indigenous peoples while acknowledging and asking forgiveness for past mistakes by missionaries. With this explanation, Mr. Chair, I hope the following becomes clear. The Holy See confirms that Inter Cetera has already been abrogated and considers it without any legal or doctrinal value. Two, the Holy See, in accordance with Catholic social teaching, is consistently paying particular attention to the relationship of indigenous peoples to their lands and resources. Three, the Holy See has demonstrated also by our support for the recent declaration of the rights of the indigenous peoples, and it will continue to be an outspoken moral voice in support of the dignity and rights of all indigenous peoples. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Señor, muchas gracias por sus palabras. Hemos recibido varias recomendaciones en el foro permanente para tratar estos asuntos y yo invito, mediante usted, a la Santa Sede ser parte de estos grupos de trabajo para justamente discutir con amplitud estos temas que para nosotros es importante y ha marcado nuestras vidas por siglos. Y solamente quisiera recordarle personalmente que cuando los españoles llegaron al Perú, llegaron con la imagen de Santiago y Santiago. En nuestros países se conoce como Santiago Mateindios. Eso es lo que queda en la memoria nuestra, señor. Doy la palabra a la señora Tonia Gonella Frichner, que seguramente tiene algún comentario que hacer. Señora Tonia Gonella tiene la palabra.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to make a very short statement and to thank the distinguished representative from the Observer, Holy See, for his kind remarks. And I would like to direct our delegates attending here at the Permanent Forum's ninth session that many of the points that the Holy See representative brought to our attention have been addressed in the preliminary study. And I would bring to their attention that the document that they should be addressing is E/C.19/2010/13. And I would direct their attention to paragraph 15 and to paragraph 17. I understand, and we have had meetings with the representatives of the Holy See, and that we have been advised that the Sublimitas Deus of 1537 had been abrogated. However, I would point out that this particular approach towards indigenous peoples, this doctrine of discovery, has been institutionalized in law and policy. This system of violence has been put in place. And the doctrine of discovery may not have value for the Holy See for centuries. But, however, I would kindly and respectfully bring to the attention of the Holy See, this is something that has been brought to our attention as indigenous peoples most recently. And since it has been recently realized, it is something that we are going to approach with due diligence because that is our responsibility to our ancestors, to our people now, and to the seventh generation that hasn't arrived yet. So I would thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for your time.
Yeah. Señor Bartolomé Clavero, usted puede hacer una intervención más corta. Estamos con muy poquito tiempo.
Sí, quiero referirme también, gracias, señor presidente, a la intervención del representante de la Santa Sede, porque da la circunstancia de que soy profesionalmente historiador del derecho y que las explicaciones que ha dado sobre la derogación de las bulas que permitieron la invasión de América por España y por Portugal no se sustentan en el derecho canónico, en el derecho canónico de la Iglesia Católica, donde el principio que ha alegado del ex posterior derogat priori, la ley la posterior derogat a priori, tiene un efecto muy limitado, porque la Iglesia considera que, aparte del derecho positivo, existe un derecho natural y por encima un derecho divino. Y dichas bulas fueron manifestación de lo que la Iglesia entendió un derecho divino. Y esas bulas nunca han sido derogadas. El Código de Derecho Canónico, el Códex, ha tenido un efecto derogatorio muy limitado, que no ha afectado a nada de lo que la Iglesia considera derecho divino o derecho natural. Por eso aprecio lo que ha dicho, en el sentido de que la Iglesia quiere ahora, la Iglesia Católica, quiere considerar tal derecho que permitió la invasión de América como derecho ya no vigente. Pero el impacto actual está ahí. Y en concreto el obispo actual de Roma, el actual jefe de Estado de la Santa Sede, mantiene posiciones absolutamente tradicionales de que lo que llama la evangelización de América fue un derecho de los indígenas de América, hoy todavía defendible, y cuando el representante de la Santa Sede se ha referido al derecho a la educación, al derecho al desarrollo, parece que no los cualifica en consideración de la libre determinación de los pueblos indígenas que la Iglesia nunca ha reconocido. Aunque el obispo anterior de Roma, Juan Pablo II, fue más sensible para estos asuntos que el obispo de Roma actual. Finalmente, veo más problemas que respuestas en la intervención del representante de la Santa Sede.
Gracias, señor Clavero. Hemos llegado al final de la 11ª sesión. De conformidad con nuestro programa de trabajo, mañana por la tarde, el foro permanente celebrará un debate de medio día de duración sobre los pueblos indígenas y los bosques. El documento de referencia es E/2008-E43-E/C19-2008. Sí, bosques. Sí,
bosques.
¿Qué dije? ¿Qué dije?
Was a mistake in the translation.
Ah, tuve algún problema, creo, señalar que el tema es bosques. El foro seguirá examinando el tema 7 en su 12ª sesión mañana, miércoles 28 de abril del 2010, a horas 10. La Secretaría tiene importantes anuncios que hacer.
Thank you, sir. I have just one announcement to make. The Indigenous Caucus will meet at 3:00 in the afternoon in room E on the second floor of this building. And the room only holds about 60 to 80 people. So please keep that in mind. There will be interpretation provided for this event. And also our esteemed chairman asked me to thank our interpreters for giving us a few extra minutes for this meeting. Thank you very much.
Levanta la sesión.